Wherein consisteth Christ's exaltation? Christ's exaltation consisteth in his rising again from the dead on the third day, in ascending up into heaven, in sitting at the right hand of God the Father, and in coming to judge the world at the last day.
We now turn in this catechism question to the other side of the coin. We've looked at humiliation, Christ's estate of humiliation. We now give our attention to his estate of exaltation. These are two sides of one coin. And so you have the diagram on the board behind me. We saw there are successive steps down, ultimately to the grave, and then back up. We start at the throne, we end at the throne. There's a symmetry, if you will, to these two things. Christ humbled himself in his birth, in his life, in his death, in his burial, in the grave, and then he undertakes this estate of exaltation as well. And so now we're going to look at each of these components as we stair-step back up the ladder, if you will. Catechism helpfully puts these things together. So the first is resurrection. The first thing that happens after Christ abides under the power of death for a time is he is resurrected. Now, this is an absolutely cardinal doctrine, a central doctrine to Christianity. If you take away the doctrine of the resurrection, you take away biblical Christianity. So Paul makes this point in 1 Corinthians 15 when he says, listen, if there's no resurrection of the dead, then Christ isn't raised from the dead. And if Christ isn't raised from the dead, then you have believed the gospel in vain. You are mere fools. So he's saying it's indispensable. And you'll note, if you go all the way back, you know, beyond the Shorter Catechism and some of the other Reformed confessions, back into the ancient church, you know, prior to the seven ecumenical councils, we have the first creed, if you will, the Apostles' Creed. And you'll note that one of the articles, one of the doctrines in that creed includes the resurrection. Because in even that tight little summary of kind of biblical doctrine, resurrection is that important to be included. Now, at the resurrection, we have all three persons of the Trinity involved. All three persons are involved in the work of Christ being raised from the dead. So here we're speaking about a physical resurrection. It's not that Jesus came out of the grave and had some mysterious ghost-like body or entity. The body that went into the grave is the body that's raised from the grave. Now, granted, it's changed. It's not the same, exactly the same as when it went into the grave, but it's the same body. And this is why Christ can show Philip and say, see the hands, see my side. I mean, it's me. It's my real person, right? My real physical body. So Christ is raised from the dead. This is him. This is the Lord showing at the resurrection his triumph over death, over sin, and over Satan. It's showing the stamp, if you will, of God's acceptance of the sacrifice which he's offered, the vindication of Christ himself. But the resurrection is more than that. The resurrection is part of our salvation. So when the Christian is brought into union with Christ by faith through the ministry of the Holy Spirit, we are united to all that to him and to all that he's done. And so Paul will make important points about our salvation being connected. He was raised or resurrected for our justification. So the doctrine of justification is tied in part to Christ's resurrection. Paul also makes the point in Romans that his resurrection is tied to our sanctification, to our growth in grace in the likeness of Christ, so that the power of the resurrection is communicated to us, received by us, and that is what enables us to die to sin and to triumph over sin and to grow in the likeness of Jesus. We'll come to some of those truths later on in the Catechism. But the first point of exaltation is being raised from the dead. His body is not left. In Psalm 16, his body was not left to see corruption, but the Lord exalted him. The second thing is his ascension. So this is another doctrine that's often overlooked. We'll talk about the resurrection a fair bit. We'll talk about the cross, of course. But his ascension. And there's something dramatic happening here. Christ is raised from the dead, and then he continues for a space on this earth, ministering to his people, his disciples, and preparing them for his departure to go back to heaven. And at the end of some of the Gospels, and at the beginning of Acts 1, we have a description of the fact that he was received up out of their sight. So this Redeemer, this Mediator, the God-man, leaves earth and is received with the clouds of heaven back into glory. So Christ talks about how this is going to happen before when he's speaking in John 14 to 17, prior to him going to the cross. So Christ ascends to the right hand of the Father. And the Psalms have several references to this. We have many scriptures which speak about it. But part of what happens is Christ is being received as the victorious, triumphant King into the throne room of heaven. And he's given, among other things, the Holy Spirit, which then he pours out upon his people. So here is Christ, who has the fullness of the Spirit at Pentecost in Acts 2, pouring out his Holy Spirit upon his people. Christ had told them, I'm going away, I'm going back to glory, to heaven, to my throne, but it's to your advantage, because you'll be given the Paraclete, the one who will come alongside, an advocate, a comforter, who will dwell in you. And so Christ ascends to the right hand, where he serves us as prophet, where he serves us as priest in his ongoing intercession, where he serves us as king, ruling over all of his enemies. So there's the ascension of Christ. He has all power and authority given unto him. And that authority is executed at the right hand of the Father. Now let's be clear, that includes his physical body. His physical body his resurrected body went to heaven and made a glorified body in that case. But his body is in heaven. So the fact is that what Rome wants to say, what Roman Catholics want to say, they want to say, well, Christ's physical body is in the sacrament. It's in the Mass. No. Christ's physical body has a limited location. It can only be in one place at one time, just like our body and just like his body was during the time of his earthly ministry. And that location is on the throne at the right hand of God. The Lutherans want to say something similar. They want to take divine attributes and attribute them to his human qualities so that his body can be by, with, and under the bread and wine and the supper. No, that's not true. Christ's body is in heaven itself. In other words, when we were speaking about Christ in his incarnation, I made a passing reference to the fact that, Calvin said, the finite cannot contain the infinite. Christ's physical body is finite. But Christ's divine attributes, as God, cannot be limited to anything, much less to his physical body. So as the second person of the Trinity, he's of course taken to himself this human nature, but he's still omnipresent. His human nature isn't, his divine nature is. And he's still omniscient and has those other divine qualities. But his physical body ascends to heaven. The third thing is his session. This is speaking of him being seated in heaven. So in Presbyterian churches, you know, we'll refer to the session. You have the deacon's court, and then you have the session, which consists of the minister and the ruling elders, right? It's the seating of the elders to conduct their business, if you will. Christ is seated at the right hand of the Father. So the Puritans would refer to the fact that there is human dust on the throne of heaven. It's kind of a graphic way of saying, look, there is a physical body that is on the throne of heaven, Christ's human nature. And there is work that's to be done. So it's not as if he is passive or inactive, but he is carrying out the work of prophet, of priest, and of king, of subduing our enemies and carrying out all of the other aspects of these three offices. The fourth is the judgment. So the culmination of history, Christ's second coming, when he comes back, it'll be the last day. All of mankind will be assembled before him to give an account. He will rule and judge, usher in the new heavens and the new earth. The reprobate and unbelieving go to hell or to the lake of fire. His people are given access and entrance into the kingdom of heaven, the new heavens and the new earth. So there's all sorts of biblical passages which talk about this. But there's a difference between days and the very final day. There is a final day that is coming. And at that final day, it'll be the last of all days in which Christ, as the exalted King and Lord, as the mediator, will triumph in the open display of his victory over his enemies and over the securing of his people and so on. Well, given the truths with regards to Christ's exaltation, you can appreciate why Paul says we should be setting our minds on things above. We should be seeking those things which are above, where Christ is at the right hand of the Father. Our affections, what we love, should be fixed on heaven, in heaven, with Christ, above the created things and above the things of this world. The thing we love most is found not here, but in heaven. Our mind and our hearts are then fixated upon that place where our prophet, priest, and king is, in heaven itself. It also is an incentive for us to prepare for death and for the judgment. We will give an account before Christ. Everybody's going to come to Christ. Everybody's going to confess that he's Lord. But some will do so believingly, submissively, lovingly, and joyfully, looking at all the benefits of salvation that God has given to them. Others are going to be assembled forcibly and wickedly, in hatred to Christ. It teaches us to prepare for death and judgment. Well, we see here that Christ has taken our nature into heaven to represent us as one who is fully God and fully man, as our mediator. He's taken our nature into heaven to represent us. But the Lord has also left us with our nature in earth to represent him. We're called, in the capacities that God has given us, to represent him. We're witnesses. You know, we are those who are to go and to set forth all that Christ has commanded and to disciple the nations. And so we're left to represent him as servants of the great King in the desire that his glory and majesty would be spread throughout the world, that his fame would be set on high. So question 28 says, wherein consisteth Christ's exaltation? Christ's exaltation consisteth in his rising again from the dead on the third day and ascending up into heaven and sitting at the right hand of God the Father and in coming to judge the world at the last day.